The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events office. And tonight, it's my great honor to introduce Mark Leibovich. Mark Leibovich's books include the number one bestseller, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. Referred to by the New York Times Book Review as a vastly entertaining and deeply troubling exploration of the political culture in Washington, D.C., it laid bare what at the time felt like the rock-bottom extreme limits of our capital city's shameless greed, corruption, narcissistic self-promotion, and downright absurdity. How naive we were. Mark's other work includes the book Big Game, a beyond-the-playing-field analysis of professional football at its precarious economic and social peak. Former chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and a former correspondent for the Washington Post, Mr. Leibovich recently joined The Atlantic as a staff writer and as a contributing political analyst for NBC and MSNBC. He also won the 2011 National Magazine Award for his profile of journalist Mike Allen. He joins us tonight with his latest book, Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. A soberer sequel to This Town, it's a no-holds-barred account of Donald Trump's collaboration with the Republican Party to transform the once-proud GOP into a cult of personality mired in corruption and anti-democratic values. And that's me as an objective introducer. Thank You for Your Servitude, says a review in the New York Times, concentrates less on the MAGA true believers, the likes of Steve Bannon and Marjorie Taylor Greene, than on the twisted and tormented souls in the Republican establishment who could have prevented Trump's hostile takeover of the party, but didn't. Such Republicans, in Leibovich's assessment, made Trump possible, and they refused to stop him even after the U.S. Capitol fell under the control of some madman in a Viking hat. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Tracy Matisak. Tracy is an award-winning broadcaster and journalist, and if you've turned on the radio in the last several years, you've likely heard her voice, as I do often. She's also a great friend to the Free Library, particularly us here in the Author Events program, where she has conducted some of our finest interviews. So without further ado, folks, please join me in welcoming Mark Leibovich and Tracy Matisak.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you all so much for being with us tonight at the Free Library. We are delighted that you could join us. And we do have some time budgeted for your questions for Mark at the end of our conversation. So if you have a question or something like that you'd like to follow up on, just raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. But in the meantime, let me just say, Mark Leibovich, welcome back to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
It's great to be here. This is, I think this is my third time. Yeah, no, it's good to be back. And the crowds just keep getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. One day I'll fill the place. So.
Well, and we were reminiscing the last time that I saw Mark, he was here with Ray Didinger a few years back. So it's great to have you back. Thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you for your servitude. We'll jump right in and then we'll get to some audience questions as well. But Mark, a theme that runs through the book is the joke yeah. that everybody was in on in Washington during the Trump presidency. What was the joke?
It's a great question. So basically, there's an expression in Washington, and it sort of evolves. But the expression, as you said, is, oh, so-and-so gets the joke, meaning they understand the unspoken truth that we're all dealing with here. Now, when I wrote a book about Washington 9 years ago called This Town, the joke was different than it is now. The joke 9 years ago was, okay, I'm a Democratic senator. my Republican senator friend here, we know that we're going to go into business together. We're going to leave our jobs. We're going to be lobbyists. And we know that there's really no such thing as Democrats and Republicans in Washington. There's only millionaires. There's only people. And that is a very cynical but often very true version of how many people who come to Washington having all kinds of ideas about how to change Washington and never leave sort of see their public service, right? So, you know, there's no such thing as Democrats or Republicans, only the Green Party. That's the other expression. So that was the joke 9 years ago, and that was a different joke than what it is now. And what you would hear among Republicans these days is, look, we all get the joke. And what the joke is, or generally referred to, was we all know that the guy that we have completely pledged allegiance to, the guy that we have given over our party to, is not fit to be president, not someone we fundamentally respect. But, you know, we're going to sort of ride him, and we're going to sort of hope he can bring us our reelections, our tax cuts, our deregulations, our judges, whatever, you know, they have to sort of swallow for the joke. So basically, the joke was in the White House, and it's kind of a harsh thing to say, but every Republican I talked to and that you would talk to around Washington for the last 6-7 years knew that, you know, they had a sort of a problem in the White House, or at least something that had to be managed, and that was the joke that they all basically were tiptoeing around but couldn't speak explicitly about because it would be bad form to do this on the record. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was the dirty little secret we were all dealing with, and, you know, we could write about it or report on it as much as we could, but ultimately that was like kind of the dirty little secret of Washington during the Trump years.
Let's talk about some of those people, because as you write in the book, so many of them were fiercely anti-Trump in 2016. You know, you talk about, you know, the people who called him a moron and he's a kook and he's unfit and on it went. Yeah. And then became the genuflectors, the sycophants, the brown nosers, the suck-ups, all of the terms that you used.
I struggled to find new terms, by the way. It was always my favorite. I really did. It was like I wore out this thesaurus, and like one of them, my favorite was the dutiful cadre of the president's turd polishers. That was courtesy of Charlie Sykes, the publisher of The Bulwark. Give him special credit in the acknowledgments. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Well, so yeah, let's talk about, I mean, Lindsey Graham comes to mind for starters.
Sure.
The pilot fish.
The pilot fish. Yeah, meaning, okay, so the pilot fish, this is not my description, but Steve Schmidt, who is actually a fairly ubiquitous commentator on MSNBC, described Lindsey as a pilot fish. I'll back up with a different animal metaphor. Lindsey Graham said that he always looks for alpha dogs. When he was a kid, the alpha dog he liked to hang out with was his father, who owned the little small-town saloon in South Carolina called the Sanitary Cafe, where little Lindsey, whose nickname was Stinkball, great little nickname, he was kind of the mascot in the bar, and he was always with his dad. And so Lindsey was the pilot fish, and his dad was the kingfish. Lindsey was the maybe lap dog when he was little. His dad was the alpha dog. John McCain became his alpha dog when he came to the Senate. John McCain is this towering figure, revered around the world, sort of, you know, he could go into like hotspots around the globe. He'd be into all these, you know, pretty high stakes negotiations. He'd have access to the White House. Lindsey was his sidekick. He was always sort of a professional sidekick to John McCain, gave him access to all kinds of rooms. So McCain was the alpha dog and Graham was like the sidekick. And then, and this is where it gets kind of twisted, John McCain gets sick, he dies, and Lindsey Graham kind of traded up for like a new alpha dog, and that happened to be the President of the United States. And Lindsey became kind of like the pilot fish to the kingfish in the White House. Now, the pilot fish is a, what's the word? Parasite. It's a fish that lives off the detritus of a big fish. It is not a noble fish. It is merely well-fed. And you know, when you are a close friend or perceived to be a close friend of the President of the United States or a towering senator, there is a lot of benefit, a lot of sort of political nourishment you can acquire being in the shot, right, being on the golf course. And Lindsey Graham describes himself as sort of an adrenaline junkie. He needs to be on the golf course with the president. He loves it. It keeps him, first of all, reelected in South Carolina, which is a very red state. It also keeps him in the frame. And he said, like, I want to be at the dice table, and this is sort of an addiction for me. And he's pretty open about it in a weird way. Lindsey was an alpha lapdog, which is what I called him.
And then you had Kevin McCarthy, right, who, you know, was separating out the Starburst and pulling out the colors that Trump didn't like to give him Starburst. But then after January 6th, he says, I've had it with this guy. I'm going to suggest that he resign. And then before January's over, he's at Mar-a-Lago.
Yep. So Kevin McCarthy, similar to Lindsey Graham, he wants a job. I mean, Lindsey needs to be a U.S. senator. One of his colleagues said, Lindsey Graham needs this job more than any other person in this office. He doesn't have a family. He doesn't have much of a life outside of this chamber. Kevin McCarthy wants to be Speaker of the House. You know, like any member of Congress, you want to try to be Speaker of the House. And he figures that if he can lead Republicans to a majority in November and be elected Speaker, all of the indignities that he's undergone for Donald Trump, for his colleagues, will be redeemed. So McCarthy, and look, the rule of the jungle in Washington in Trump is just total sycophancy. And Kevin McCarthy was on Air Force One flying somewhere with the president. Notice that the president only ate the pink and the red Starburst, discarding the yellow and orange. I miss it. That's right. Yeah, Starburst. Did I say Starburst? I said Starburst, the candy. Okay. So Kevin, being the very resourceful suck-up that he is, decided that he would make a special gift jar for the president in which he would assign a taxpayer-funded staff member, I don't know who this person was, I will get to the bottom of it, to separate out all of the yellows and oranges so that the president wouldn't eat them. The president was very moved by the gesture. So, so that is what Kevin McCarthy did. And that's like a real pro move. Like, if you want to suck up to the president, you have to have an attention to detail like that.
And, Mark, you know, you talk about the needs that people had, you know, to be in the Senate, to be the Speaker of the House. When you look at the sheer volume of people who had made that decision to hitch their wagon to Donald Trump, ultimately, was it, as someone once said, ambition untethered to principle? What was at the bottom of it? Was it just pure ambition that was across the board for so many people, or what was underneath all of that?
I always think it's got to be more than ambition. I mean, first of all, these are not necessarily new stories in Washington. I mean, there have been naked opportunists, desperate opportunists in Washington and in every city, but Washington is sort of known for that behavior for decades. It's an old story. It's doing what it takes to make it work for oneself, one's career, whether it's, you know, keeping donors happy, whether it's getting reelected, whether it's, you know, getting on TV, whatever the motivation of the day is. What Trump did is he basically applied a lot of the same rules, there were a lot of feckless, sort of amoral people in Washington willing to make a particular deal to make it work for them in Donald Trump's Washington, which required sacrificing of principle to a degree to which we'd never seen before. So you are justifying, if you are like, say, Lindsey Graham, suddenly you're justifying, you know, okay, I said that I would never support a Supreme Court justice being nominated the year of an election, even though I said exactly the opposite 2 years ago, and now Mitch McConnell, you know, nominates Amy Coney Barrett, just a few months before the election, you know, just sort of flips around that, doesn't try to justify it. He sort of runs away from the reporters. And then, you know, next thing you know, you're justifying a insurrection on the, you know, on the Capitol on January 6th, and you know, you just sort of run and run and run, and next thing you know, you're sort of completely untethered. But, you know, it's a bizarre, series of events and series of compromises that people will make. And, you know, the question is, how do they live with themselves? You know, these are not questions that they generally like to engage on.
Well, and you asked a number of them about legacy and how they would want to be remembered. And you got some interesting answers or an interesting theme that ran through that.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I talked, Rudy Giuliani, Trump himself, McCarthy, Graham, even Bill Barr had a sort of erudite version of this, which is, you know, how do you want to be remembered? Do you ever think about what your grandchildren will read about you in history books, what your legacy might be? And almost to a person, they would look at me like I had two heads. Like Kevin McCarthy, I remember at one point he said, "Oh, you mean the Jeff Flake question?" I'm like, wait, what do you mean? And he said, well, Jeff Flake, you know, Jeff Flake was a very principled conservative congressman from Arizona. Then he went to the Senate, very principled conservative senator from Arizona, deeply religious, and he had no interest in catering to Trump. And he basically said, okay, this is not worth it to me. I'm willing to lose my job over this. I want to be able to sleep at night. And, you know, he was going to lose a primary in Arizona if he ran again in 2018. So he kind of skipped that, and he retired from the Senate. He actually became ambassador to Austria under the Biden administration. So everyone in the Republican Party is like, okay, see, he was a Democrat all along. But McCarthy used to say, oh, well, where's the Jeff Flake statue in the Capitol? Like, who's talking about Jeff Flake now? I mean, he's out of a job. Giuliani would always say some version of, you know, I don't give a damn. Actually, I don't give a fuck. Sorry, everyone. About my legacy, I'll be dead. Trump said a couple days after the election, you know, if I lose this election, that'll be my legacy. Barr said something to the effect of, I don't believe these big Homeric hymns are sung to the living about their contributions. I mean, one after another, you know, Graham always said, I don't care. So it became nihilistic after a while. And look, I mean, you can argue that, okay, this is just solid gold cynicism, whatever you want to say. But what stands out to me are those who do take a bigger view, who do think in terms of the going beyond the day-to-day expediency of keeping Donald Trump happy or winning the next election. I mean, Liz Cheney is a great example. I mean, she's someone I spent a lot of time with, and you know, say what you will about her, and a lot of liberal people I know still like roll their eyes at her because of Iraq, because of her father, and you know, any number of reasons. But she said, "Look, I want my kids to be proud of me when they sort of look back on my life and my career." You know, that this is for history, this is about the Constitution. I mean, you know, big themes. Yeah. And, you know, I respect the hell out of that. You know, and then people of faith, like Mitt Romney, or people who have family legacies, like John McCain. I mean, you see a lot of the sort of recurring themes people who tend to take a bigger view, a lot of military people, like Adam Kinzinger. I mean, but you know, on the other side of it is just a really sort of cold, calculating, and kind of depressing view of their role in this world.
Before we move on, one other question about Liz Cheney, because you wrote about the price that she has paid for taking the position that she's taken, and you even made a visit to Wyoming, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, I might even go back next week. Actually, it could be her final, her primary is middle of August. I think it's the 16th or something. This is kind of the last stand for her. I think she's likely not to win her primary. Mm-hmm. She's got a very, you know, Trumpy opponent. I think they seem pretty, you know, coalesced, around her opponent. You know, it'd be a big surprise, I think, at this point if she won. She's not backing down. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if she kept right on running and right on, and you know, and maybe ran for president or something after, if she loses even.
And she's got all kinds of security. I mean, it's been very difficult.
Yeah, no, I interviewed her a couple times, but once it was in the secure undisclosed location. Remember, Dick Cheney had a secure undisclosed location after 9/11. No one knew where he was. Mm-hmm. Became kind of a joke. But the secure undisclosed location I interviewed Liz Cheney in last summer was the Dick Cheney Federal Building in Casper, Wyoming, which was like trying to enter like a prison. I mean, it was like there was like so many layers of like metal detectors and security checkpoints, and you know, very few of her events were publicized. She had a massive detail, and you know, I can imagine why. I mean, she's taken a very lonely, but I think courageous position.
Yeah, I want to talk about somebody who kind of went part of the way with Trump and then bowed out. Paul Ryan. You write at length about him, and in particular, I was interested in his take on January 6th, because you had quite a conversation with him about that.
Yeah, Paul Ryan, so he was the Speaker of the House. He had very little use for Trump. He was sort of a disappointment to a lot of people on the right because Trump didn't like him, and you know, he was fairly unshy about his disrespect for Trump. You know, and a lot of people on the left said that, you know, he was pretty ineffective. He didn't really stand up to Trump. You know, he got his tax cuts. What does he care? He retired. He sort of went into private, you know, business. You know, he joined a bunch of boards, did what a lot of former office holders did. I remember he said, you know, I got to move back to Wisconsin. I mean, I've been in Washington too long. I want to be with my family. That lasted like 6 months, and he moved to suburban Maryland. Paul Ryan is a complicated guy. It's not black or white. I think people, you know, people inhabit gray areas here. He was out of office. He was watching January 6th unfold in his, either I think it was in his house or home office or something. And, you know, all of a sudden he watches what's happening and he sees his old security detail and his old, you know, sort of some of his old staff people, you know, in the middle of this total bedlam on the Hill. And he described just bursting into tears and just saying, you know, I just completely lost it. I'm not much of a crier, but I was just like, I was just overcome by what I was watching. And I, you know, I jumped in. I said, now, Mr. Speaker, were any of these tears of complicity? Could you have done more? Did you have any responsibility to sort of, you know, lead the Republican Party and the supporters of Donald Trump to this point? And, you know, as we're sitting here, you're still sitting on the board of Fox News, 100% true, you know, which is kind of the elephant in the room here. And he did not want to go there, did not want to talk about this, at least on the record, didn't really say much off the record, to be perfectly honest. And he, so he was happy to let that lie. I'm sure he gets paid a lot by Fox. So, you know, it's not a perfectly clean, you know, show of regret here. But again, it's complicated. I mean, that's about as generous as I can sound there. So.
One of the characters, if you will, in the book is the Trump Hotel.
Yes.
You decided to kind of anchor the story there as opposed to the White House. Why the Trump Hotel?
Well, the White House. Okay, so the Trump Hotel was this beautiful luxury hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue that the Trump Corporation opened in 2016. It's about halfway between the Capitol and the White House. It's just gorgeous property. And it was sort of the Republican capital of Washington for 4 years. It was like, it's kind of like, you know, Cheers, right? It was like, but instead of like Norm and Sam like yucking it up over Norm's tab, I mean, it would be like a Saudi lobbyist, you know, yucking it up with Congressman X over, you know, a large campaign donation or something like that. I mean, it was really right out of like Rick's American Cafe, right? I mean, just like, oh my God, gambling is going on here. I mean, it sounds like, it almost sounds fictional, but it was like every night you would see this. And a lot of reporters would hang out there. I would not under, you know, left to my devices, this is not a place I would hang out. But, you know, there'd be a lot of us there. We'd get a lot of work done. We would see each other. We'd see these, you know, members of Congress after their Fox hits. We'd see Rudy getting drunk and running outside to smoke a cigar with, like, red wine staining his tuxedo shirt. And Treasury Secretary Mnuchin had a suite there, and he had this new young wife who had, like, a little, literally a purse dog, literally a literal lap dog she would walk around with, you know, a lot of the same lobbyists, a lot of the same, you know, members of foreign government. I mean, it was bizarre. And so you go in there, and the... What's that French word? Sorry. Oh, pièce de résistance. Very good, right?
Impressive. Nicely done.
Would be when the president himself would come in to eat. And Trump himself agreed to eat in one restaurant in all of Washington that was not the White House. It was the steakhouse at the Trump Hotel. And, you know, the Obamas used to sneak out for these date nights, right? And they would, like, you know, be all discreet about it. Maybe they'd sneak in the kitchen, you know, greet the staff. They'd go to these trendy little bistros and you know, Georgetown or something, and then they'd sneak back to the White House. Maybe they'd get spotted, maybe not. Trump needed the big applauded entrance, like, in a big way. He needed like, just people standing on their chairs, chanting his name. And he would go in with, like, a little entourage, sometimes with you know, Lindsay, sometimes with Ivanka, sometimes with Melania. You know, there's always, you know, he had sort of a core group. Ordered a 40-ounce tomahawk steak, well done, fries, shrimp cocktail, chocolate cake for dessert, sometimes apple pie, every single time. And also a chilled bucket of little Diet Cokes, because, you know, the diet, he's got to watch the weight, got to watch the waist, right? So, and then he would wait, he would linger, and then just when he knew that the crowd was expecting him to leave, he would leave. And, you know, if you were lucky enough to catch Cinderella at the castle, you know, you're a tourist, you know, you come up, you don't expect to see Cinderella. Maybe you take a few pictures of the castle, but there he was, and he'd leave, and it was always quite a scene, and like, tourists would be lucky to see it, and they'd be taking pictures, and paparazzi. It was, again, bizarre. A word we're not supposed to use because it's, like, not descriptive, but it was bizarre.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
I want to talk a little bit about January 6th itself. You just mentioned, you know, the accolades when he would walk into the hotel, and then you contrast that with the time period. Well, first of all, immediately after the election, when mm-hmm. everybody was saying, you know, he's in a very dark mood, he's in a very bad place, yeah. And that you heard people say something to the effect of, what's the harm in humoring him, going along with the big lie,
yeah.
and saying, well, what's the harm for humoring him? In fact, it's the title of a chapter in the book. And then January 6th comes, and we see what the harm is in humoring.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the worst anonymous quote of all time. It was in the Washington Post, and it was a senior White House aide saying, you know, what's the harm? You know, we're just, let him like have his, like, he'll get to a better place in a few weeks. You know, he'll hem and haw, and eventually he'll come around. I mean, you know, this was emblematic of being, you know, the city was governed by the feelings and moods of this, you know, in large part, toddler in the White House. It's like, okay, let him have a little time out. Maybe he'll come around. I mean, it really was. I mean, the language of raising a problem toddler or a challenging toddler was not totally dissimilar to what you would, to the words people would use to describe the president and handling the president. I mean, he was a very high maintenance and needy guy. And so, I mean, I assume I'm not telling anyone anything they don't know, but yeah, so it's like, okay. I mean, Lindsey Graham was saying, let him give it time, give it a few weeks. McCarthy was, they're going on TV saying the election was stolen, and they're humoring him. You know, this was kind of like a head shake, and was like, okay, fine. And then weeks passed. You realize that the Republican platform for, you know, basically 4 years was humoring Donald Trump. It was like the actual platform in the Republican Party from 2020 was like a three-line description, which basically said whatever he wants, whatever he wants. And so next thing you know, no one's actually marching down to the White House and saying, Mr. President, enough, which is how Watergate ended. I mean, that's how it ended for Nixon. You know, Barry Goldwater, a bunch of other sort of elder statesmen, Republicans marched down to the White House, said, Mr. President, you know, you're losing support. Mm-hmm. It's time. And, you know, Nixon, for all of his Nixon-ness, had, like, you know, I guess he had the requisite shame, or at least, you know, whatever the baseline that he had. I mean, he left, okay? Yeah. I don't know what else his choice was. You know, he probably would have been impeached and maybe convicted or sent to jail. I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. But that never happened. And largely it's because they were afraid to. And then next thing you know, the Capitol is under control of like a madman in a Viking's hat, right? Or a Viking helmet or whatever. I mean, and it's like, okay, that's how we got here. And people died. And it's still like, to this day, you know, you watch these January 6th hearings and, you know, this is the price of submission. This is the price of cowardice. And it is, I mean, did anyone see the hearings last week? So Josh Hawley, who like does this big fist raise, and, you know, then there's this little, I mean, the committee is very deft in, like, throwing in these little sort of chocolates on the pillow. You know, he's running through the hallways of the Capitol. I mean, again, though, I mean, that is a perfect distillation of the kind of two-faced, you know, on one hand I'm doing this, and on the other hand I'm running, you know, in the other direction that we saw. And it does stand in quite a bit of relief to what, you know, to other acts of courage that have not been non-existent. I mean, it's you know, the witnesses, the Republican witnesses before the committee have been telling very courageous, patriotic truths. The Conservative Party in England basically stood up to Boris Johnson and said, enough. Okay, so that's courage. Okay, in a non-political context, you know, the Ukrainians, like, resist every day. They literally fight for their country. President Zelensky, you know, is actually right there with you. Like Trump said, I'll be right there with you. And, you know, whether he actually wanted to go to the Capitol or not, and I don't really buy that he was. What's he going to do, like, put on a general's uniform, right? But he, you know, he went back to the most secure location in Washington. And I don't, you know, I don't care if you support him or not. It's just not a stand-up thing to do. And it's sort of maddening to see how rare that's been, even now, at this late date.
So speaking of the hearings, do you think they will move the needle at all?
I think they already have. And I didn't expect that I would say that. I think it's been very effective. I think they've been really well done. I love the lack of speeches, the lack of sort of long-winded, you know, grandstanding answers or questions from every member on the panel. So yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised.
So we were talking before we came out here about some news that came out today regarding the DOJ investigation. Do you have the sense that is ramping up now?
It sounds like it. Yeah, this is breaking news. I so rarely get to deliver breaking news. Yeah, just as I was walking in, I checked my phone. This is a Washington Post report, and said the DOJ is investigating the president, former president, as a criminal matter from January 6th, and I think they've subpoenaed a bunch of phone records. I mean, it sounds definitely like a ramped up kind of thing. And, you know, I see a lot of nodding. I think if nothing else, and this is not a small thing, the January 6th commission has probably sped the Justice Department along here in a way that I think a lot of people were urging them, the Justice Department, to be sped along.
Yeah. And meantime, Donald Trump is talking about running again. He said something as recently as yesterday or today about maybe doing it yet another time.
Yeah. I think he will run again. I mean, I think the question now is, and you know, the question is when. I mean, I think Republicans seem to would like him to wait at least till after the midterms. He seems to want to do it sooner, and I think there's probably a calculation on his part that it would help insulate him from whatever criminal investigation he's being subjected to. I don't know if I buy that. I don't know if Merrick Garland buys that. I think, you know, when you try to do it this early, it's a little transparent. So I'm not sure that's you know, that would be a factor here. But yeah, I think he will run. And I also think if he runs, he'll win the nomination for the third time in a row. And you know, there's a lot of people who say, well, you know, Ron DeSantis is getting a lot of press, and a lot of people are sort of warming to him. And you know, this is my personal view. I don't know DeSantis, but I don't think DeSantis would beat Trump. I think Trump would win the nomination. I think someone like DeSantis is someone who probably wouldn't scale well. I mean, people I know who served with him in Congress, Republican governors who served with him, you know, they kind of describe him as kind of a weird dude. And, you know, Trump, you know, could probably do some real damage to him, I think, over a long term, because Trump is really good at branding opponents, especially those who are not terribly deft at sort of thinking on their feet and naturally charismatic.
Speaking of opponents, what about the Democrats? Do you see Biden running again? Is there somebody else within the Democratic Party who could step up and carry the mantle? How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Democrats, I mean, breaking news, they got some major problems. President Biden has major problems. You know, it's tough. I mean, I think Biden, the problem that he has is he was basically retired. I think his biggest contribution to America was, you know, something he did like right after, you know, November 2020. He beat Donald Trump. That's sort of what everyone wanted him to do. He was the most electable. That's why Democrats picked him. He scared the fewest number of people. He was a known quantity. He was decent. He was not tweeting like a madman through the night. He was not, you know, saying racist stuff. He was not insulting veterans. I mean, you know, go down the list. It was a really nice sort of change, I think, for a lot of Americans, which is why people voted for him. The problem is, you know, he wasn't getting any younger, and he had a full four-year term in front of him, went into a tailspin about a year ago and doesn't seem to have recovered. You know, I do think I'm one of these people, and this might, I don't think, in fact, I know that the White House views this differently, but I think he should just limit himself to one term. I think it would be a breath of fresh air to Democrats to sort of send a message that they're not afraid of the future, turn it over to some young voices. And I think Biden's concern, first of all, you know, Biden has every right to run again. But, you know, there is this sort of risk aversion that I think Trump has sort of created, not just in Republicans, but in Democrats. I mean, the Democrats, when you have an alternative like Trump, I mean, you're going to go for your safest choice. And Biden, you know, almost by default now, for the second election in a row, is going to feel like the safest choice. I think that the second he says, I'm not running again, it would just sort of open a whole bunch of eyes. It would unleash a whole bunch of energy. I think, you know, you ask who's the bench. I mean, Kamala Harris doesn't seem right now to be the obvious heir apparent. But I also think that after the midterms, some Democrats who win could immediately be national figures. I mean, John Fetterman here in Pennsylvania, Tim Ryan maybe in Ohio, Stacey Abrams. I mean, I don't know. Go down the list. I mean, all you need is I think some people will immediately get a look if they are able to win in November. And, you know, but I think either way, Democrats, you know, have a tough election cycle to get through first, and we'll see where that leaves them.
Yeah. Well, I have lots more questions, but in the interests of time, let's go to our audience questions.
Thank you. You've provided reasons that Republicans gave for supporting Trump, but couldn't it be accounted for as a cult leader? They were in love with him, and it was their emotions that were driving them?
Sure. I mean, look, I'm not an expert on cults. I mean, I would say that there's a lot of things feed devotion. First of all, when you only have like a couple choices, I mean, people make choices for very, very different and strange often reasons. I mean, I certainly agree with you that Donald Trump has a spell over his supporters. I don't know if it's born of, you know, healthy choices, healthy impulses. You know, I'm not going to make a blanket statement about, you know, about what is being driven there. But I will say this, and I don't discount the level of, frankly, just really strong dislike that a lot of his supporters have for people on the coasts, people with money, people who they perceive to be, you know, elitist, who look down upon them. I mean, there's a real, you know, there's an expression that there's a conservative theorist named Charles Murray, who's pretty controversial, who wrote an essay. I mean, for a lot of reasons he's controversial, but he had an interesting essay right around the election that said that Donald Trump is, like, to a lot of his supporters, Donald Trump is not a hero. It's not someone they emulate at all, not someone they care to defend, but he's a tool of revenge. Right? And he pisses off all the right people. And that's a powerful thing for a group or for a political coalition that, first of all, has lost a lot of elections and feels that they've lost a lot of status in the culture and, you know, maybe professionally over the years. I mean, there's a lot of factors at work. I mean, it's hard not to sound simplistic about it, but I don't know. It's not like there was a lot of goodwill for Hillary Clinton either. I mean, it was like there's some, but it's like elections are just sometimes just choices between two not great options. So.
Let's say that Biden did, as you mentioned, say, okay, I'm handing it over to the next generation. You know, you might have an open primary, and you don't know what would necessarily emerge from that. Right. What would you... In a way, what would you hope would emerge from that? And if you have anybody in mind, I know that's... You probably wouldn't want to make any bets on that.
Yeah, I would say that... I will say very generally, as a matter of taste, I would love to see someone under the age of 60. Okay? Maybe 65. I mean, you know, I don't want to discriminate against anyone. You know, I'm kind of burnt out by older leaders. Again, sounds ageist. I don't mean to be, but You know, Nancy Pelosi is over 80, I think. Jim Clyburn is almost over 80. Steny Hoyer, Bernie Sanders. I mean, you know, go down the list, right? So Donald Trump, I mean, he's 70, what, 6, 7? Yeah, I'd like someone younger. I think I would love to... This sounds like a cliche, but there's such a hunger for authentic characters, people who can do the job, but who don't fit a normal profile. I mean, that's one of the things about Fetterman. I mean, you know, I don't know much about him. I have not ever met him. I mean, he seems interesting. He seems, he dresses very poorly, but that's, you know, people say, I mean, look, is he bald? Then I completely agree. I don't know. Like, turn it over. I mean, like, we've had a lot. I mean, there has not been. I mean, just like bring other people. I mean, again, this is not a real answer, but I think I would not be afraid. I would hope that whatever the field looks like, Democrats and ideally Republicans. But I mean, speaking of the Democrats, are just sort of give up whatever risk aversion has been seemingly the driving force in saying, okay, Hillary's the next person up, Biden's, you know, the safest choice. I mean, you know, and Biden, I mean, Obama obviously was going to run for re-election in 2012, but I mean, so, you know, you can't, I mean, it's, he's sort of an obvious nominee, but, you know, it's, let's start a new queue here, you know.
Given us some reasons why some members of Republican leadership sacrifice their reputation, satisfy their legacy to defend Trump, can you speculate why some of the commentators, some of the media-like commentators on Fox News have done a similar thing, from my perspective at least, satisfied what were previously, you know, respected reputations, legacies, to do exactly the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I honestly, I don't think you can ever underestimate the power of Fox. I'm of the belief that if Richard Nixon had Fox, he would have survived he would have survived Watergate. I'm almost certain of that. I mean, you know, Fox, they will say that, you know, we're a serious news organization. I mean, there's just this blockade at prime time every night, you know, of Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, and Tucker Carlson. And, you know, they're the three most watched cable news shows. And, you know, we at least know that Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity had serious doubts and ambivalence and, you know, fear, whatever you want to call it, around January 6th. They sent their little texts to Mark Meadows, to Ivanka, to whoever. And then, you know, spent a good part of the next year pretending that never happened and just sort of memory hold it. I turn the cynicism up several notches, you know, when it comes to Fox. I think it's probably a business proposition. I think if Sean Hannity decided that he was going to turn on Donald Trump and basically did this nightly drumbeat supporting Ron DeSantis or Mike Pence or whoever, he would probably hear about it. But either way, I mean, evolution of courage, you know, in any of these people is going to be the salvation of any of us. I mean, it's a dispiriting thing to watch because it's so powerful and it's sort of so cynical to sort of see play out night in and night out. I mean, I don't watch it a lot these days, and I have, you know, and I guess there are still some real journalists there, but I don't know. I don't really pay a lot of attention. You know, I like him. I mean, he's a very thoughtful guy. You know, he had a real roadblock when he ran in 2020, which is African American voters. Like they really had zero interest in supporting him, it seemed. And so, but no, he's been very impressive. He's great on TV. He's great on his feet. He has been, you know, I think he seems like he's been a really effective cabinet official. You know, he's still really young. He's in his 30s. But sure, I mean, I think there are some people who ran. I mean, Amy Klobuchar is someone who people don't talk about now, but who actually ran a fairly effective campaign last time, still in the Senate, still reasonably young, who I don't think is talked about that much. But, you know, I've heard more and more lately. And then there are people like, you know, Chris Murphy from Connecticut is someone I've heard a lot about lately, pretty young senator. He's been really effective. He's been in the middle of a lot of this gun legislation. You know, he's been very visible, especially after Sandy Hook, and quite popular across the aisle. You know, very appealing guy that I think will probably get some attention, you know, if he wants it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's why I think an open primary would be so valuable for Democrats. It would actually put some new faces out there, even if, like, they're long shots. I mean, Chris Murphy would be a long shot. Pete Buttigieg would be a long shot. But, like, put them on a stage. Like, let them get to know, because they're very compelling, you know, talkers at the very least. And like, you know, let's, like, meet some new people, you know?
First of all, thank you for your presentation. It was terrific. I'm wondering what the source of the evil is. That's to say, if... Is it inherent in Washington? You've got McCarthy, who switched for reasons that he wanted to be X, that he wanted to be the Speaker of the House. I guess my question is, if the shoe were on the other foot, could we expect Democratic folks, Democratic senators, Democratic congressmen to be equally as challenged?
Yeah, you hear, yeah, that's a fairly common thought exercise you hear around, like, well, wouldn't the Democrats do the same, right? Or if, you know, I don't know. I mean, I never really bought that because, I mean, they've had power. It's never happened there. I mean, look, I've said this for years, and I think it's sort of self-evident. I mean, no side has a monopoly on good people, good ideas, horses, asses. I mean, go down the list. And you know, I mean, this is a little academic, but I mean, Robert Caro, the historian, he said that everyone says that power corrupts. I think power reveals. And I think one of the lessons of my research for this book, and just of watching people operate in Washington for a few decades now, is that power reveals most eloquently about those who enable its perpetuation, right? I mean, I don't know if Kevin McCarthy would do what he's doing in a different context. And by the way, capital cities, whether it's Albany, whether it's Harrisburg, whether it's, you know, Boston or Tallahassee or Washington or Mexico City. Is Mexico City the capital? Yeah, Mexico City is the capital. Sorry, I should know this. It does attract people like this. It attracts people who are you know, trying to make it work for them, you know, who have business, you know, behind it, who have careers behind it. And it's not uncommon, but I don't know. Look, I mean, Donald Trump happened to run as a Republican. The Republican Party owns him. Without the Republican Party's complicity, Donald Trump would just be a geriatric golfer who watched Fox a lot in Florida. And, you know, he's got Fox behind. I mean, but, you know, he's got a party that keeps forgiving him. He's got a party that keeps rehabilitating him. I mean, he couldn't do that on his own. I mean, they could have impeached him twice. They could have locked arms and said enough is enough. I mean, that's what leadership is. And, you know, one of the lamer things you hear is, well, you know, I'm just following what my district wants. I mean, Elise Stefanik from, you know, Albany, New York is, you know, she's always saying, well, my district supports Trump, so I need to serve my district. I'm like, no, that's not what leadership is. If you think your president is doing something wrong, if he's in your party, say so. And I mean, you know, I guess maybe it's a different definition of leadership, but, you know, I don't think it's that complicated.
Comparing your book from 8 years ago, the central focus of it in a lot of ways is Washington, D.C., and the change from, I know your previous book started with a funeral for Tim Russert, mm-hmm. and later on in the book there was another death, but there was somewhat of a positive vibe about Washington, D.C. in the text,
right.
And now I don't see it at all, and I would like you to comment on that.
But it's a fun read, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. We're just well, fun beach read, you know, you can laugh a lot. You know, I will say this. I mean, actually, sincerely, I mean, people have laughed. It's good to have laughter. I think the stakes are higher now. I mean, this town, which I wrote, in 2013, in retrospect, feels like and reads like a comedy of manners. I mean, it was, all right, look, you know, everyone's making money and we're all having parties here and aren't these people silly? And, you know, watch them do their thing at a funeral. By the way, for those who like funeral coverage, long chapter on the McCain funeral in this book. But, you know, this is much higher stakes. These did not feel like funny times at all. And I think there are sort of different and maybe graduating flavors of disgust as the years have gone on. And I would have loved to have written another book that was maybe fun or something. And, you know, again, I think there are fun elements here. And I also think that there's a lot of unmined, you know, scorn and ridicule that I tried to, you know, I tried to render as best I could in this, because I think that there was some dark humor that, could be, you know, if not savored, certainly appreciated to some degree. But no, I mean, I just think the stakes are higher. The stakes are higher. And to write a book that, you know, was sort of a light touch book about, you know, that ended with an insurrection or that, you know, could end in a civil war or something, would have been, I think, the wrong note to hit on. So, to say the least. So,
reaching way back into campaigns where it seemed like isolated incidences made campaigns just take a nosedive. Like, for instance, with Gary Hart was seen on a boat with a woman who wasn't his wife.
Right.
And if you remember, Dukakis was doing something like with the military. And
yeah.
He
the,
did
the
this
tank.
Yelp,
yeah.
And the way his voice sounded, that the campaigns just took a nosedive. When Trump was running, and before folks knew that they had to sell their soul to him, what do you attribute that the things that he said and did not make his campaign then take a nosedive?
Great question. I would say that, you know, so this is something an interviewer said early on when this book came out that stuck with me, which is that shamelessness is a superpower for Donald Trump. He had no lines. I mean, he would say anything, he would do anything, he would tell any lie. He was not capable. I mean, okay, think about a normal person, okay? If you are caught in the number of lies and exposed for the number of embarrassments or tapes or whatever that came out about, say, me or you or anyone, I'd be humiliated. I would want to quit. I would like, I don't want any. He just kept going, and he didn't care. He didn't care how many lies he was caught in. And the problem was, you know, one of the most potent enablers of authoritarian behavior is just exhaustion. You just sort of, the viewers, the listeners, you know, the voters just sort of, okay, just as I'm trying to process what he just said, there's the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And it becomes this blur and it becomes its own kind of form of oppression. And you kind of forget, like, you just sort of lose the thread, and it's a big distraction and it's oppressive. So I don't know. I mean, that's not a great answer, but I do think that, like, he has no floor. I mean, he'll just say anything. And, you know, again, when you are above, or when you are not capable of embarrassment, it gives you a real edge. It's a kind of asymmetrical warfare. Because, you know, Hillary Clinton, I mean, for as tough as she is and as, you know, maybe as calculating as she is, I mean, she had a line. I mean, she was capable of being embarrassed. I don't know. He could not have been fun to run against, I can imagine.
I was wondering, Al Franken, do you, in hindsight, think he made the right decision resigning? And it's my sense that before this happened, he was one of the few truth tellers, outspoken. Do you think there's a way that he can come back?
You know, voters of Minnesota or New York, I guess he lives in New York now, can decide that. I mean, I know he personally regrets quitting. I think what happened in his case is the Democrats put a lot of pressure on him. They thought, I'm not sure they were right about this, but they sort of thought, okay, well, if Al Franken quits, we will retain the moral high ground, and you know, we will be able to go after Brett Kavanaugh for his, I mean, whatever. I don't think that was the right calculation. I think if he could do it again, he wouldn't have quit. You know, yeah, both Democratic, both Senate seats in Minnesota are Democrats. You know, there are some people. I mean, there are some Republican House seats in Minnesota. You know, he lives in New York now. He's made noises about maybe primarying Christine Gillibrand or Chuck Schumer. I mean, I don't know if that's ever going to be real. But, you know, Franken is like he's 72 years old or 71 years old. You know, he's got a podcast, really good podcast. I think a lot of people miss him in the Senate. I think he was effective. He was a very good investigator. He was a great question asker. He was great at questions, great interviewer. So, you know, I think Democrats really lost when they let him to quit.
Outside of Fox, do you think other media outlets have as much responsibility for the rise of Donald Trump? Because he got so much airtime during the primaries. You never saw hardly any other Republicans. Yep. And also now, all Fox News broadcasts that talk about Donald Trump are amplified in newspapers all over. I mean, it really bothers me. Like, why did they get so much press?
So other than Fox, the media is completely beyond reproach, and I have nothing to say about that. I think the media has certainly been imperfect around Trump. I think, you know, I don't think CNN should have, like, carried all of his rallies live during the... although I'm also not of the belief that, like, oh, you know, people should ignore him. No, he's president or he's the front runner. I mean, you can't ignore someone who wants that job, right? I think the media messes up in that I think sometimes they sort of follow the shiny object more than they should. I mean, even I remember one of the hearings, the January 6th hearings, as soon as they told that story about Trump, you know, maybe laying his hands on the Secret Service guy and maybe getting him to go to the Capitol, I remember thinking exactly at that moment and saying to my wife, actually, he said, that is going to become a shiny object. It really doesn't matter. It's like, okay, it's not like the Justice Department's going to prosecute him for, like, maybe laying his hands on a Secret Service agent. That is a peripheral thing. It's really far less important than whether he is, like, sending armed, you know, protesters or rioters to the Capitol. It's secondary to pretty much everything else that's been said today. So there's a shiny object that you just know the media is going to spend, you know, a couple days talking about, probably at the expense of far more important stuff. And then, you know, sure enough, the Secret Service claims that they're going to go under oath to dispute that, which they didn't. But, I mean, you know, it's just, okay, let's follow that. So, yeah, no, I mean, the media does, I think, engage in a lot of, you know, unnecessary sort of coverage of things like that. But having said that, and this is not just because reporters and journalists are my people, I think the Trump years have been just an absolute, you know, boon for great journalism. I mean, investigative, you know, commentary, breaking news, White House reporting. You know, as someone who, you know, I've probably had more common cause with conservative, you know, usually never Trump conservative, but people who are, you know, writing essays and sort of making arguments from a conservative perspective about why this is so dangerous. And you know, so I think obviously it's not perfect, but I also do give a sort of a big shout out to a lot of my colleagues. And, you know, it was not easy. It was not a fun thing to be part of the enemy to the people, and the New York Times, Washington Bureau, you know, by the end of the Trump years, we had these four armed guards that we didn't have at the beginning. You know, it was a different vibe, and it wasn't fun.
The book is called Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mark Leibovich for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.